everything that we have said from the morning session and since the break. In the morning session, we took this mandala and talked about the way in which process and structure, the ecology of the stages of structure, the ecology of the phases of process, form a unity, form, in fact, classic eightfold unity. It's classic east and west. On this level of comprehensiveness, there's no disagreement whatsoever. Since the break, we've been talking about molecular biology, about cells, about membranes, about the ionic channels. At the same time as this has been developing, over at Caltech, Carver Mead has been developing a whole new way of making computers. Because it turns out that the process, the life process, which works in us, in plants, and every life form that we can see, works in structures that are atomically synthesized by the carbon atom. But there's another atom which allows for the same patterns, the same structures of synthesis to occur, and that's the silicon atom. The basic working cell of a computer is a silicon chip. And one can make silicon chips that can see and hear. Not that are reductively responsive only to logical line commands, but computers that can interface with life. A whole different echelon of technology. Not an extension of present-day technology at all. A leap to another dimension. Organic technology. A whole other dimension. Capabilities that make what we're doing now look like sticks and stones. So one of our textbooks is Carver Mead's analog VLSI, very large system integration. Analog VLSI and neural systems, published 1989. In fact, it came out just a couple of months ago. Here's from the introduction, because it's so radical. We have to start from the very beginning. This book evolved out of a series of courses that Mead has designed at Caltech over the last 4 or 5 years. This is now the textbook, beginning in 1990, for the first classes at Caltech in beginning to train people to see this is what we need to do to begin developing this whole new echelon of technology. It's a radical jump. This book is to technology what Galileo's The Starry Messenger was to astronomy. It's a signal saying we have a whole new way of looking at everything. He begins, writes in this way, "Even the most naive observer can see that the nervous system is vastly different from a computer. Living systems are made from three-dimensional squishy cells. Computers are constructed of rigid inorganic matter in flat two-dimensional sheets. Living systems are powered by metabolic biochemistry. Computers are powered by transformers and rectifiers from the power mains. Living systems have approximately 100 millivolt nerve impulses lasting nearly a millisecond. Computers have 5 volt signal levels switching at nanosecond intervals. The destruction of a few percent of the cells in the brain will cause no discernible degradation in performance. The loss of even a single transistor in a computer, save for in its memory, may cause complete loss of functionality. The average nerve cell dissipates power in 10 to the minus 12 megawatt range. 10 to the minus 12 means that the wattage of the nerve cell, the neuron, is very, very infinitesimal. The average logic gate in a computer dissipates 10 million times as much. When you talk about clumsiness, that's a good scale to show. Just gives you some idea. The neuron of the lowly rat is 10 million times as functionally superior as the latest fancy computer, the Cray. Meade is going to be very pragmatic here because he's really like an old American pioneer. He's going to say, let's look at how the rat's neurological system works. Maybe we can learn something. Nevertheless, a more careful look reveals some underlying similarities between the two kinds of systems. Both process information. Signals are represented as differences in electrical potential. Notice it isn't that this little spark goes from there to here. The real mode of travel is a difference in electrical potential. It's like in the Buddhist Abhidharma, the pennant is not waving in the wind. The motion is in your mind. No, it's not that flag is not physically moving there. That's not that. That whole realm that's physically moving there is a movement in the mind. That is powerful. That's a whole other echelon of realization. And to criticize the ancient Yogacaran by bringing the flag to him and flapping it in front of his face, he will just laugh at you. And then close his eyes. It's true. It happened many times. Sorry. Old times. Signals are represented as differences in electrical potential and are conveyed on, quote, wires formed by surrounding a conducting path with an excellent electrical insulator. Notice, there are no wires. There are only, quote, wires made by virtue of surrounding the path by an insulator. How does wisdom move? How does prajna move? There are no roads for wisdom. But anywhere where there is a secured nothingness, prajna shoots instantaneously. That's how it works. It's Tesla's electromagnetism on a really colossal, subtle level. Do you realize that this airspace is filled with incredible energies? All we have to do is have receivers to tune them in. There are AM stations, FM stations, television stations, thought waves. Shoot, the place is alive. It's packed. Everywhere on the electromagnetic spectrum, something is occurring in every cubic centimeter of what? All you have to do is find a way to receive it, to insulate and select by doing that insulating. And there it is. Channel 4 comes in, right? It could come in right here on this desk. Every signal in the universe is occurring now in this space. All of it. Signals are represented as differences in electrical potential and are conveyed on, quote, wires formed by surrounding a conducting path with an excellent electrical insulator. Active devices cause electrical current to flow in a second output conductor due to the potential in a first input conductor. In, out. And it flows because there's more going out than coming in. And that's what in physics, in an electrical aspect of physics, is called gain. And because there's gain, every time it happens, the gain is there. I guess he'll talk about the output of, he does. The output of an active device has more energy than was present in the input to that device, hence the system possesses gain, the essential ingredient for unbounded information processing, which is accompanied by an unavoidable dissipation of energy, so that a power supply maintains a near constant average difference in electrical potential across the active devices. What does a power source do when you plug in? It maintains a reservoir of that electrical potential so that the differentials work anywhere in the system. It's not like there's a whole line of little microscopic electronic ants carrying a charge. That's not it at all. It's very mysterious. Very mysterious. The first person to ever understand this was Benjamin Franklin. If you do not think that Benjamin Franklin was one of the world's greatest scientists, you just haven't appreciated how utterly mysterious electricity was when it was first out. The best minds in the world struggled for a couple generations to try and understand what in the world is this. You know what the first electrical experiments were used for? To kill turkeys. Yeah, to kill turkeys. And there were some people in the British House of Lords saying we shouldn't waste too much money because there are easier ways to kill turkeys. We shouldn't investigate electricity just because it's a new way to kill turkey. It's true, ladies and gentlemen. It's where the British get the adjective frightful. It's frightfully true. A power supply maintains a near constant average difference in electrical potential across the active devices, so that an electrical field is actually a matrix, bounded by the functioning technical perimeters of the equipment. What in a body is that? It's an organ. So the physical organs of the human body are matrices of life energy. And they lays the life energy due to the wholeness of their matrices. So that, for instance, when you look for an index in Chinese medicine to the meridians, the organs give the index. What meridian is that? Oh, that's number 36 spleen. Number 36 spleen, yeah. Not number 35. It's not that there are road signs on little subneurobiological highways. Remember, we talked about that. The meridians are not there by what they are, but they occur by virtue of what is not there. That's the Tao of the medicine. There are no Confucian doctors in China. Those guys don't understand that. They're like the Western clods who are trying to find it by taking cross sections. Where are they? Really? The active devices, notice that his metaphors are broad because he doesn't want you to stereotype in images in an old-fashioned way. So use a generic epithet, active devices. The active devices, the transforming gates, the ionic channels, the active devices are formed of extremely thin energy barriers. What are the active devices? Extremely thin energy barriers that prevent the flow of current between two electrical nodes. The passage of current is mediated by the potential on a third, quote, control electrical node. Three again, there's that structure again. The three layers dovetailing in the plasma membrane. Three quality here in the energy barrier occurrence and permeability. That current varies exponentially with the potential on the control node. The interfacing third indexes the flow capacity of the polarity. Third time pays for all, they used to say in the RAF. Heartened by these less obvious but deeper similarities between the two systems, what two systems? Computers and neurological systems. Heartened by these less obvious but deeper similarities between the two systems, we may be tempted to conclude that the brain is indeed a digital computer. Its nerve pulses encode information in much the same way as do pulses in a telephone exchange. Neurons perform Boolean, that's from the 19th century mathematician philosopher George Boole. Neurons perform Boolean and or operations on the way to firing off a nerve pulse to the next stage of computation. Small neural memory elements store information in much the same way as computer memories do. Perhaps we are, after all, on the verge of discerning one of nature's most profound and best-kept secrets, the working of thought itself. Speculations of this sort were rampant in the 1940s. Now he's going to temporize everything that he has said. 50 years ago. Speculations of this sort were rampant in the scientific community. Why then at that time? Because the first computers were being really made at that time. Yes, there are forerunners even as far away as Pascal, but the first real computers that we would recognize as direct line ancestors to what we work with now came into being at that time. And let's let Carver tell the story. A film depicting the operation of the whirlwind, the religious significance. God speaks to Job out of the whirlwind. You don't remember that? A film depicting the operation of the whirlwind, an early vacuum tube computer with magnetic core memory, was called Faster Than Thought. Was made, in fact, in 1953. And their tongues were out, I guarantee you. The field of artificial intelligence was born. Soon, however, signs of distress could be seen. By 1977, Marvin Minsky, one of the artificial intelligence pioneers, opened a seminar at Caltech with the following observation. This is 12 years ago. This is Minsky. Our first foray into artificial intelligence was a program that did a credible job of solving problems in college calculus. Armed with that success, we attacked a high school algebra. We found to our surprise that it was much harder. Attempts at grade school arithmetic involving the concept of number, etc., provide problems of current research interest. An exploration of the child's world of blocks proved insurmountable, except under the most rigidly constrained circumstances. It finally dawned on us that the overwhelming majority of what we call intelligence is developed by the end of the first year of life. And no one can go that deep. Did they sit around staring at babies? Yes. Tongues out, indeed. Meet again. Just another paragraph, please. The visual system of a single human being does more image processing than do the entire world's supply of supercomputers. You talk about remote sensing and parallel processing. Let's talk about it. The digital computer is extremely effective at producing precise answers to well-defined questions. The nervous system accepts fuzzy, poorly conditioned input, performs a computation that is ill-defined, and produces approximate output. The systems are thus different in essential and fundamentally irreconcilable ways. Our struggles with digital computers have taught us much about how neural computation is not done. We've learned by way of arrogant assertion that we are abusing what is possible. And tongues are back in, and lips are closed. By 1990, everyone is very, very interested now in shutting up. Unfortunately, they have taught us relatively little about how it is done. Part of the reason for this failure is that a large portion of neural computation is done in an analog rather than in a digital manner. So you see all the fancy technological equipment that says digital on it, with nice Japanese lettering. Let's wait. When the machines in 25 years read analog and use silicon chips that interface with our own neural plasma membrane informed systems, can you understand that that will be a whole different realm from this one? So different that you could, in historical parentheses, include what we are now living in as the last of the Neolithic. That cave days are as continuous with what we are doing now as they will be, what we are doing now is discontinuous with what is possible in one more generation. The colloquial way is to say that there is a jump in capacity, quantum jump in capacity. There's no way to take the present and imagine what that new capacity is like. It's like the old science fiction novel Flatland. Two-dimensional figures could never imagine a third-dimensional world. It's just beyond them. It's not possible. Why? Because the imagination is nature-based. But the jump to new realms is supernatural. Supernatural. It's in a whole different dimension. I won't go on too much with this, except just to emphasize that if you can get a hold of this, this is one of our textbooks. Not only does Carver Mead's analog VLSI and neural systems go in a primordial way with the molecular biology of the cell. These are two of our textbooks in the science. But this third one, The Philosophy of Niels Bohr, the great physicist of quantum dynamics, The Framework of Complementarity, also goes with it. So that these three books, these three textbooks, form a very interesting triad in our science section. If you look at the program and you get out the page on science, you'll notice that there is the distinctive three-part. There are two structures and then an interface, which we have been using all the way through. Every particular quarter of this educational program, and you're now in the eighth quarter, has had the same structural element, only just now are we able to be conscious in a reflective way and realize what it is that we have been doing. And if you've been following it, if you had been doing it in this way, there would be a very powerful snap right now. Two processes, a movement and a counter-movement. A process of things and a process of processes coming into interplay. In where? Not just now in the real, but just now in the realization. So that the third, the stand, is the realizing, trigger-pulling moment, the interface moment, the event of aha, philosophy, love of wisdom, begins in wonder, saith Plato. It's just like love begins in a moment of realization. Oh, it's like that. Everything is involved. This volume, The Philosophy of Niels Bohr, is the interface of science in our time, in this course. This does it. These two volumes, The Molecular Biology of the Cell and The Analog VLSI and Neural Systems, are the first movement. And this is our third week, so we'll spend next week yet on these. And then we're going to shift our stance. Instead of standing on the left foot and moving, we're going to shift our weight to the right foot and move that way. And the two books for that are The Particle Explosion and The Cosmological Distance Ladder. These two books, The Molecular Biology of the Cell and Analog Computer Making Neural Chips, I guess we can use that phrase. I don't think Carver would mind. This deals with like the structure of where we are. This is mediate structure, the structure of our minds, the structure of our bodies. This deals with the structure of human, the human level. The second movement deals with the structure of large-scale, astronomical, and subnuclear levels. So the first movement starts where we are, and the second movement takes the farthest reaches of where we are not, the subnuclear and the extragalactic. But where we are interfaces with the subnuclear and the extragalactic. Where does it interface? It interfaces exactly where realization comes to understand that the all means the all, including us. And hopefully, if the educational program has worked and works through the science level, You'd be very glad to start reading the old mystical theology of Dionysius the Areopagite or the Aeneids by Plotinus. You'd be very glad to be able to cool out with such companions. It's like a philosophy professor of mine at the University of Wisconsin. Somebody got the idea finally of how to do existential aesthetic analysis based on Maurice Merleau-Ponty, and then said, "Well, but Dr. Kalin, what do we do now?" And he turned, his bow tie bristling and his smile very hard as ice and his eyes lively and challenging. He says, "Live."